I wear many hats in the startup space. 5 startups over 16 years, and you know, I came from more of an operational technical background. With work, it's like, okay, well, using things like Airtable, Jira, and internally for my personal like to-dos, and I'm very much a fan of like always using the inbox as fast as I can. So like, when I have an idea, I try to dump it in there. Personal pet projects or family, any open loops with my errands, chores, ideas, wishes, dreams, really lives in OmniFocus.
You're listening to The Omni Show, where we connect with the amazing community surrounding the Omni Group's award-winning products. My name's Andrew J. Mason, and today we learn how Rick Manelius uses OmniFocus. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of The Omni Show. My name's Andrew J. Mason, and this is where we interview the people and stories surrounding the Omni Group's award-winning products. Today, we're excited to have Rick Manelius with us. He's the founder of Atomic Form. It's a company revolutionizing how we interact with digital art and media. Rick has a passion for bridging technology and creativity, bringing innovative solutions to the forefront of the digital landscape. His work focuses on redefining user experiences in a rapidly evolving digital world. Rick, we're honored to have you on here. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for the time and opportunity.
And so grateful to be able to talk about Atomic Form because it is, I mean, we're talking bleeding edge at the very forefront of what's happening here. I could foresee possibly that Atomic Form is one of those really difficult cocktail conversation, like we're at a party with people who may or may not be in the space.
Yes.
And somebody just comes up to you and says, Rick, what do you do? Like, how do you even begin to package that and answer that for them?
Oh my gosh. I love that framing. You know, when I was a track coach in college, I used to tell people, like, depending on the athlete's background, I might have 4 or 5 different instruction types, because the same set of instructions or the same answer to all 10 would result in completely different results. But if I could tailor the answer. And so like when my mom asks, I just say like, I work on computers. And she's like, that's great, son. I'm like, awesome, mom. But depending on someone's background, I'll say, well, first of all, we work in the digital art space with NFTs. And again, if they're like, oh, cool, I got that. It's like, great. Mm-hmm. The next sort of pass is like, look, art is not just the art itself. It's the history, it's the stories, it's the context that makes things value. The Mona Lisa is not the most valuable painting in the world, and 10 million people don't visit it just because it's beautiful, right? They go there because it's famous. And if we're going to have on-chain digital art, permanent on-chain digital art, the stories, history, and context should come along with it. So at the end of the day, what we do is we make it trivial for artists, collectors, and curators to package and connect that data on chain so that the history, stories, and context lives alongside the art as well. Increases its value, but also increases its ability to connect with people because, as you know, it's so hard to like follow everything on the internet. Things are coming, going, websites are crashing, going away. And we don't want people to lose their most valuable asset, which is not just the NFTs itself, but the stories and context that go along with it.
That's really a brilliant way to kind of package that because, you know, you've heard the talk before about, is it a monument or is it a conversation? And the internet that is Web 2.0 that we see is absolutely conversation. So latest, loudest, always in the front of people's faces. And what I see Atomic Lore is maybe entering the conversation as saying, hey, let's pull out some of those significant pieces of the conversation and put them back into the space where it's more of a monument, more something to be appreciated. And Atomic Lore enters the conversation. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that's exactly it. One of the hardest parts about Web3, NFTs, and crypto, I mean, obviously there's the whole like, you know, there's scams and there's money and people get like very allergic to that. But like, once you get past that barrier, they're interested, they're curious. It's like, well, how do you get started, right? And it's very ephemeral, social media, TikTok, X. If you're not very online and very much watching the pulse of it, you feel like you can never catch up. One of the most beautiful things that we've been able to do is create these like time capsules, these like communal memories by which you can kind of relive the experience. We kind of think of like time hop. You know, you could bring someone new and say like, hey, here was the 30-day period where this drop happened, where all these big artists and all these big like brands were talking about this and all the hoopla, all the energy, all the conversation. And you have a permanent sort of capture of that experience, that moment, that energy. And a lot of these artists will like drive people to our site because they're like, I want people to relive that same experience. I want people to be able to see what it was like to be there. And since it's permanent on chain and growing, you'll have multiple sort of time capsules as these pieces go around the world, as they go to different shows, as different things occur. And you're able to bring newcomers who, again, back to my mom, who can't necessarily understand what the digital art is, but like, oh, go check this out. Like, just kind of stream through this and just kind of see what your reaction is. Like, oh, that's cool. Like, I saw they're in Venice, or I saw like there's this experience or this big thing on the wall, this big mural and all these people around it. And so it makes it more approachable and it makes it more long-term because, you know, I like to think in decades. I like to think that when these artists are, it's not just like, how can I make money now? It's like, how do I inherit these assets to my kids? And, you know, if you think about in 10, 20 years, right, when this becomes part of your IP, part of your property, you want to make sure not only the IP is not damaged, meaning that it's on chain and it's permanently available, but all the stories and IP around it is captured such that they can use it if they're making income off of it, or just to be proud of their parents and just being like, hey, this is part of our history, our legacy. And so I think that's kind of what drives me. I've worked in a couple archival companies in the past, large digital asset media systems that powered things like Bob Dylan archives, 30, 40 years of live footage and audio, like how to slice and dice that so that way it's preserved. But also every time there's an opportunity for a jingle or a movie or whatever to access a particular clip or a particular scene from a particular time and place, that information can be available. So we're trying to sort of take that same pattern in the sort of Web 1, Web 2 space and really apply it to these new on-chain digital assets called NFTs.
It's a challenge in terms of the education component, I know, but it is a question worth asking. We haven't asked this question before. We have maybe in the physical space, but not when it comes to digital things. And preserving those stories around the artifacts themselves, I think, is also what, like you were saying, retains the value for that.
It's not just art, too. I don't want to sort of like make this broader. For people who don't care about art, this is for everybody. Like, there's this old lie that I was told when I first went to school, which was like, everything on the internet is there forever. Like, I went to college in 99, and like, it's like, don't put it on the internet, it's going to be there forever. And the reality is, 80% of all links die in 10 years. People are finding now their MySpace pages that 2008, 2009, that spent all this time to like, oh my God, this thing's going to be there. You know, GeoCities, AOL. Eventually, you know, X will change and Facebook will change and all these places will change, right? And so people offload their digital identity to these platforms, which may or may not include them forever. Even YouTube, right? You know, the prices went up recently and their Gmails are starting to cull old accounts and, you know, old email threads, et cetera. So like, the more that we trust digital properties to store our memories and our milestones and those important memories that we have, including our pictures of our kids and everything else, we go back to look at them only to find out that they're not there anymore. And then all of a sudden we have gaps in our memory. I have photo albums from my parents that I've inherited, right? They're physical. I could store them in a vault and I could protect them. But when I left Facebook, I actually purged my account and I lost, frankly, a lot of photos of my kids that I uploaded there, but I don't have a copy of my phone. And that's memory loss. It's experience loss. It sucks. And so we're not trying to capture all things, but we're trying to say, what are the things that you want to keep forever? And so whether that's an art, we can expand this to sort of beyond. This becomes more of a general purpose problem of, how do you store your legacy in a way that can live longer than you?
I love the history component of it too. It actually provides a great transition for us as well into the Omni Group. You mentioned you utilize OmniFocus to get things done in day to day. Do you have any recollection or memories of when you first came across the Omni Group themselves, or maybe more specifically OmniFocus, the software? Or was it just kind of like this, you know, over time, I just realized that's what it is and what the software does?
I actually look back at my 1Password and I think I first signed into the Omni Group website around 2011. So it's now been, I guess, 13 years. So in college, so at MIT, I was undergrad and grad student. Getting things done was one of many solutions that really made like MIT doable. I considered myself a smart kid, but like a hard worker. I wasn't like the natural genius, but I was the, you know, smart enough and work hard enough that I could usually achieve most things. But high school never prepared me for like what it really took to go sort of at an elite level. And when you go to like a school like that, you need every possible trick, tip, hack you can get through the day. And so getting things done with David Allen was like one of those magic solutions that really sort of helped me take that overwhelm and make it feel more manageable. So I started doing like workshops. I would actually, when I was a grad student, I would teach other undergrads like, hey, you may not have learned how to do productivity management or this type of workflow in the past. Awesome. So, you know, run a class for 5 to 10 people. And then through like Merlin Mann, and, you know, he was running 43 folders and some other things. So OmniFocus became one of those tools, I think, that was like how to apply the GDD system. Because early, you know, 2006-07, there wasn't really, like, you could kind of make your own system, but there really wasn't a solution that said like, hey, let's sort of digitize this and really embrace the GDD workflow. There's some tools you can kind of force a GDD workflow into it. But I think OmniFocus is like, no, this is a getting things done style app. And so that was key. And then I think the reason I stuck with OmniFocus, and also I use OmniGraph, OmniOutliner, a couple other tools along the way, OmniFocus is the one that really stuck, was because it had the multi-app sync. You know, like, obviously with getting things done, you don't want to be able to capture things from all places, right? So multiple work and personal laptop, phone and or tablet. And so that ability to synchronize my workflow across whatever device I was close to was very important. And I think OmniFocus early on really mastered that well, such that I could trust it for all my personal to-dos. I answered beyond your question, but yeah, really where I met Omni Group was somewhere on between Merlin Mann, 43 folders, and like 2011 was probably where I met you guys.
Yeah, no, I love the context surrounding it as well, because it was kind of, you talk about this moment in history where things are preserved. You know, there was kind of like this movement where this idea of how to manage an enhanced workflow spread through more effectively, especially when we're encountered with all of this extra digital information. For somebody that maybe finds themselves in that space where their responsibilities are expanding maybe, or they want to take on more, but they haven't really quite figured out, you know, the next step, hack, trick, whatever to do it. Doesn't have to be GTD, doesn't have to be OmniFocus related, but do you have any kind of good first go-to, like, hey, if you're really trying to take a next step in the direction of expanded responsibility or trying to apply yourself, but for somebody that is just looking for a good or, you know, multiple first steps, that biggest bang for your buck, lowest hanging fruit, what would you suggest for them?
I think that's a great question. And I've done this both personally and organization-wide, which is, the first trick is just to like do a one-time brain dump of all your open loops that you ever have. And that is usually a very shocking experience, because I think most ambitious people, they don't realize how much mental RAM they're already committed to. And so if your roles and responsibilities are expanding, now all of a sudden you're about to embark on this new greater list of things. I'll tell a very quick story. Like at one of my organizations, we had grown from like 8 to 50 people at the time. And we were having trouble delivering against like 250 clients. And, you know, things were getting a little stressful in the system. And, you know, we kept saying like, why are we having such stress getting things done here? Because we have 50 people, you know, it's not, the number to projects doesn't seem off. Well, then we said like, well, we knew people were kind of doing some internal projects. We called them internal projects. And we're like, we know people are doing these things. And one day we're like, how many of them are there? We literally handed out note cards and we said, everyone write down every sort of side project or internal tooling or cool idea or whatever that's not client focused, and let's put them on a wall. And we had 250 client projects and we had 350 internal projects.
Holy cow.
And that moment was like so clarifying when you all of a sudden people are like, holy crap, the balance, it should have been maybe 5-to-1 client projects and internal projects, or at best 1-to-1. I mean, at the most extreme 1-to-1 or whatever. But when we found out like, you know, 350 meant 7 internal projects per employee, and we're like, guys, that's just insane, right? You're taking on too much. And so I think the first gut check for a lot of people is like, how much are you already committed to? And I think for me, whether you do get anything done or use OmniFocus or whatever, like, the thing that's always like a stark reminder every day is when I open up my OmniFocus and I see things past due, I'm like, damn, like I already have a lot of open commitments. Like I already have, like I'm already behind. So when someone's like, hey, this next few thing, I'm like, it's a forcing function. So I would say just the acknowledgement of what you already have open is, I think, the first step to make, you know, it's the first step to identify a problem, is like just acknowledge the problem or just understand, is it a problem? And I think that's, for most people, a good place to start. And if you are one of the lucky few that don't have too many open commitments, like you've been pretty stringent or your responsibilities haven't pushed you to a point, that's great. You know, then you have more flexibility. But I think most people, when they're seeking a solution like this, already unconsciously acknowledge the overwhelm. They know they want to fix it, but they don't know how to get started. And I think the first one is just acknowledge what you got.
I love the term you just used, forcing function. To me, that means it's an iterative thing that makes you arrive more at accuracy. I think a lot of times, because it's our brain's the same tool that's using this thing, that's also executing on this thing, we tend to have this optimism bias that says, you know, I think I've got it. You know, I understand what it is that I'm committed to, no big deal. And then when you actually sit in front of you, externalize, you're like, oh, okay, that's more than I thought there was. Do you mind placing maybe OmniFocus in an overall context for yourself? So is there, in terms of software flowing into it, or the data gets exported out of it, or maybe not necessarily just from a technical standpoint, but how the workflow uses where OmniFocus sits in that overall space?
I wear many hats in the startup space, 5 startups over 16 years. And you know, I came from more of an operational technical background. Now I'm the CEO role, but I'm very familiar with Jira and all the, you know, Trello, all the project management systems. And I think OmniFocus is not the appropriate tool for a team solution. It's really, I think, more of an individualized one. So at the end of the day, I try to, you know, follow the David Allen philosophy. It was like, you want to keep the number of systems you use to as minimum as you can tolerate. And so for me, with work, it's like, okay, well, using things like Airtable, Jira, and internally for my personal like to-dos and personal pet projects or family, you know, any open loops with my errands, chores, ideas, wishes, dreams, really lives in OmniFocus. So I'm very much a fan of always using the inbox as fast as I can. So like when I have an idea, I try to dump it in there. I will have some other note documents that I keep as reference, because like OmniFocus really isn't a place you want to keep like long-term reference materials. So my overall workflow is generally like I use the inbox very liberally. I have like 5 or 6 main top level categories, just one personal, one work, one just general crypto because I'm learning stuff in the general space. I have an AI one because I'm also learning stuff in the AI space right now, and a couple others. And so if I have a consulting client or like any sort of mentorship I do, I'll usually have a global bucket. And then I have sort of subfolders and then sort of projects within that. Really, I think the two main drivers for me is I like to use the due date one because obviously I don't want to miss certain deadlines. So the due date is like someone to hold to be accountable. The weekly review is also a great Sunday night steering method where it's okay, all these things I sort of thought I could handle, do I still believe that? Do I still want to or sometimes my enthusiasm for something's waning. Like I put an idea like for funsies, let's go try this. And then all of a sudden I find out, well, life got busy, not as important. I thought it was a good idea. And so my big three, I think, is inbox capture, due date driven, always that it's much better than a calendar. For my calendars, you get distracted. There's all the other stuff going around it. But it's like, this is literally the things in which order have to be done by certain dates. The folders and stuff are obviously very helpful when you do your weekly review and kind of see how are you balanced, work personal. And, I try not to keep too much work in my Omni focus because again, that keeps it in my bucket, but not the team's bucket. But if there are certain individual tasks that I know are in Jira, but I need to track against my own sort of commitments, I'll bring in a copy of it into the tracker, like the Jira ticket number and maybe the title, because that way, when I'm sort of in my internal mode, I can sort of keep it all with me. And then only when I need to sort of bridge information over, do I sort of jump into Jira and do it over there. I don't force my employees or anyone I work with to use a GDD type system for their own stuff, because I think the team-wise, we have to use team tools, but everyone is sort of allowed to use whatever personal workflow things they need to sort of track their stuff, and that's fine. But I find that without OmniFocus, I would definitely miss a lot of things.
Yeah. For stuff that isn't necessarily carving out new territory for you, it's not necessarily a brand new thought every single time. Do you have anything that fits the space of routines, habits, and how does that look? How does that play out for you? Yeah, it's not necessarily where the context will remind me I should put on pants because I just woke up this morning. That's context. Sure. Versus, it is something I do want to make sure I do. I do want to make sure that this happens once every month, every quarter. How does that look for you?
Oh, absolutely. No, I have a lot of recurring tasks. Repeat again, especially if I'm trying to do new habit formation, I'll put do every day or do upon last completion. And I'll use other apps too. I have one that's more of a dedicated habit formation app that I'll use. Again, it's not OmniFocus because that one's very much driven about repeatable patterns to develop a new skill or have that experience. So I try to keep my number of repeatables in OmniFocus to a minimum, usually to new stuff I'm trying to develop, only because I want to continue to balance the overwhelm. Right. I don't want to you don't want to brush your teeth in OmniFocus because you just do that. Right. So things that are just already baked in routines, you just kind of ignore out. But anytime you're trying to seed yourself, you committed to this. You want to keep going to this thing every day. So a fit and right project folder, whether it's health, whether it's getting in shape, whether it's some sort of new health regimen or a new skill I'm trying to learn. And if I'm really adamant about it, I'll usually have it in a repeat pattern for 30 to 45 days or so. And once I feel like I'm actually internalized it, then I'll sort of kick it off because then it's sort of an autopilot.
It's in there.
But yeah.
Is there anything that you would consider to be a mistake or a misstep along the way that, I thought this was a great idea for my system, tried it out, executed on, it worked for other people, might still work for other people, but for me, it just didn't pan out the way that I was picturing it would.
Flags and context. I was pretty hardcore about that in the beginning. I love the idea of it, but especially as we're more remote, mobile, where context is less useful or tends to be more work to keep track in the context. And I actually find myself saying, let me find what actions I can do within this context. So I would say I was more successful until my responsibilities grew. And then as they grew, adding that layer or managing that layer stopped adding value to me. But there is value in doing the weekly review of going project by project. I stopped doing it for a while. Honestly, it was I kept thinking maybe I don't need it. And then one day, about a year and a half ago, I started to go through the weekly review function. Oh, crap. There's a lot of things I kind of filed through without due dates. And I'm it's just sitting. Some of that moment of re-putting the index cards in the wall is oh, crap. There's a lot of stuff here that just kind of got tucked into corners and whatever. And I had to kind of take a 4-hour period to kind of okay, let's either re-engage or delete it. Either it's not important and I need to get rid of it or really recommit and get this commitment done. And so one thing is context doesn't seem as valuable to me anymore, but weekly reviews, I thought I was past, but really when I started re-added it back into my life, I was the weekly review is very important. I need to force myself to go through those buckets again.
Kudos to you for forcing that clarity. I mean, it's so easy just to let the clarity go by and just not finish the thinking and just let it be out there or whatever. Last question. We'll let you go because I know you're super busy, want to respect your time, but I would love to know, and this is so open-ended, feel free to take it any direction you'd like to, but what would you say makes you passionate about being as productive as you possibly can in your life? There's so many options for productivity enhancement. What is it about being as productive as you possibly can that drives you and says, you know what, I want to make sure I have that edge in order to be the best person I can be?
I don't think I had that drive growing up, but I think when I got to MIT and, you know, I saw, you know, what's possible, and it's you know, I think everyone's born with gifts or opportunities to like achieve, whether it's your personal skills that you have or talents, et cetera. And it's like, I just find the world so beautiful and fascinating and fun and interesting. Like, I'm never bored. My Amazon books, man, like I buy stuff. I just have so many interests. And the reality is like, look, I'm a responsible parent. Like I have two young kids. Like I want to make sure I have a good life for them. I want to both ensure that I meet my obligations as a provider, but also like that I get to go have these experiences as a person, like both things I want to learn, things I want to do, things I want to experience. And a lot of that is being able to achieve things, being able to like learn new topics. So that way if I go scuba diving, I can do it well. Or if I want to start learning a new hobby or exploring new interests, there's just so much interesting things in this world and only we get one life to experience it. So I want to be productive so I can get the things done I need to get done so I can get to the fun stuff that I want to do.
Speaking of artifacts that are preserving moments in time, I'm so grateful for this one. So thank you, Rick. I really do appreciate that. And honestly, well thought out answer and conversation. If folks are interested in finding out more about Atomic Form, what you're involved with, what you're up to, and they just kind of want to orbit in your space, how can they do that?
Yeah, the best place for me is I live and breathe on X. So x.com/Rick Manelius, M-A-N-E-L-I-U-S for me personally. And then x.com/atomicform, all one word. We are very prolific. We engage a lot with the art collector curator community. And then you can obviously go to our website, atomicform.com.
And you also, one more thing we didn't want to forget too, is you wrote a book as well. Is that true?
Absolutely. It's called Save Your Startup. I just published it last year. The inspiration is I've been a mentor for various accelerators, specifically Techstars. I've done like 4 or 5 cohorts, been a mentor and advisor to a lot of other startup founders. Just like I did at MIT, like I ran those training courses using like sort of getting things done and other things like 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, et cetera, to really equip these students who are already bright and brilliant, but they sometimes just needed a little bit of guidance and frameworks and flows in order to like, again, achieve and graduate and excel at all the things that they were doing. Startups are the same way. You have a lot of energy, finite time, finite money, and you got to do a lot with a little, right? And so having gone through and learned a lot of hard lessons in life, some successes, some failures. Like I wanted to sort of compile a lot of the best I've learned and sort of compile it into like a sort of playbook. You know, it's no David Allen Get Things Done, but it's certainly a way, it's like a book that I would love to have read on my first journey. It would have helped me so much to know certain patterns, best practices, and mindset to attack first-time founder stuff. So I now sort of in a getting things done methodology, like I can't mentor everybody because I'm running my own startup. So whenever people ask, I'm like, hey, here's a book. Here's a lot of playbooks of all these different facts and ideas and frameworks that I've used. Please read it. And if you have any more questions, I'd be happy to, you know, set up calls. But it really helps force multiply my own efforts to help other founders who are trying to achieve big dreams and goals like I am.
That's fantastic. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. Appreciate it, Andrew.
Hey, and thank all of you for listening today too. You can find us on Mastodon at The Omni Show at omnigroup.com. You can also find out everything that's happening with The Omni Group at omnigroup.com/blog.